So the final presentation for today is by Philip Carlson, Biomimicry in Chemistry. Utilizing creative things for scientific inspiration.
All right. Thanks for sticking with us today. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about biomimicry and how that relates to chemistry. So my name is Philip Carlson, and this is the first time I've ever been able to attend an ASA meeting, although I've been a member for a number of years. And so I want to start by telling you a little bit about me and where I come from. Essentially, I live in Jackson, Mississippi, and not unlike Tulsa, it's also ridiculously hot and humid at times. So you never get used to it, but you experience it a lot, I suppose. At Belhaven University, we are a Christian liberal arts university, and we're a little bit unique because we are one of 30 schools in the United States to be nationally accredited in all four of the arts: dance, music, theater, and visual art. So the main push of Belhaven for the longest time has been in the arts, and it's very unique for a Christian school in general to have a nationally recognized dance program that hosts the international ballet competitions. We have about 3,725 students university system wide. Of course, on our Jackson campus, only about 1,500 students. Our mission is to serve and not to be served, and of course, to support Christ through our careers, human relationships, and in the world of ideas. We have a number of extension campuses and so on and so forth. I'm sure probably not very many of you have heard of Belhaven unless you're interested in the arts in some way. And that was kind of an interesting thing. Coming to Belhaven was, well, what support to the sciences do we have? And so I came at a really great time at Belhaven. One of their historic buildings called Fitzhugh Hall is actually the back half of it cracked off of the front half, and so it was condemned. And that meant that we could lobby to get a new science building. So they actually decided to make it a big push of the university to expand in the sciences, which is probably why I'm here with you today. So we've had an over 1,400% increase in the number of chemistry majors since 2011. Essentially, there was one chemistry professor who ran the whole program, and he had one, maybe two majors, and now we have 30 to 40 chemistry majors. So that makes 1,400% or more increase. Modern lab spaces. And then the question was, are we actually going to get some equipment? And they came through with money for equipment. I got a picture here of all the different things we have. So we were able to really dive into research in a number of different ways. These are research-grade equipment, fluorimeter, a diode array, UV-Vis, GCMS, all the good stuff. And we're working on getting more, and we've been approved for more requests and so on and so forth. So a really exploding time. We've added four faculty in the sciences. We've started computer science in the last 3 years. We've started an engineering program with Mississippi State. And we've added math faculty as well as biology faculty. So we're really headed on a new direction there. And one of the unique things about Belhaven is we are challenged as professors there. I teach chemistry and physics. I'm a physical chemist, so I get to teach physics as well as chemistry. And our challenge there is to integrate our worldview with each class that we teach. So we need to have some sort of worldview component, Christian worldview component, that we can hold the students accountable for. And one way that I have done that is through this area of biomimicry. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about biomimetics. We'll discuss what it is and some historical examples of it. And then we'll show some modern examples of biomimetics from the recent literature in the last 3 or so years. Then we'll talk about some worldview considerations in that area. And then, of course, we'll make some conclusions. So to start off, what is biomimicry? Well, if you go to the literature, you'll find a lot of information about what biomimetics is and how it's discussed. And primarily, most people know biomimicry through this book. And Janine Benyus, when she wrote this in 97, it was a really new concept. Not a whole lot of people had heard or thought about it as a separate discipline. And probably since the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, this area has really exploded in research, and the number of publications is exponential. And a number of specific journals just for biomimetics. So what is it at the core? The way I describe it is, find a biological system that does something very well and seek to mimic it or replicate it, you can then apply that to a new situation where you need that development or that technology that the biological system had. So at a basic way of defining it might just be the conscious emulation of life's genius inspired by nature. And the one I like best comes from this paper here in 2006 of the Journal of the Royal Society Interface. They define it as the study of the formulation, structure, or function of biologically produced substances and materials and biological mechanisms and processes, especially for the purpose of synthesizing similar products by artificial mechanisms which mimic the natural ones. And that's so many words, you might have to reread that a couple of times to try to really figure out what it is they're trying to say. But it all boils down to this idea of going to nature, the way it's been described, finding a biological system that has some advantage or some adaption, and taking that and creating a technology or emulating it in some way for your application. Now, the word biomimetics, you see it a number of different ways. So you may have heard about biomimesis, biomimicry, bionics, biognosis, or biologically inspired design. All of those terms are somewhat synonymous. And so you may have studied biomimicry and not thought of it in that way. And like I said before, the modern study of biomimetics began in the mid-1990s and really took off in the early 2000s. And so historically, where is biomimetics? What does it look like? You can probably all think of some example of a natural system that was then adapted for a new technology. So let's look at some of those. The first one that comes to mind is Chinese attempting to produce artificial silk. They knew about silk. There was the production. And of course, there's this famous painting of them trying to produce silk, preparing silk. And so it was known for a long time that the Chinese tried to create artificial silks. Of course, they never succeeded. Silk is a very elusive thing, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. You could think of Leonardo da Vinci coming up with these different flying machines in his Codex on the Flight of Birds. We know several of his flying machines were written in there. This is an example of biomimetics, going to birds and other things that fly and trying to develop a technology that does that same thing. And ultimately, what would be the purpose? Well, so humans could fly in some way. Probably the best example is Velcro. It was patented in 1951 after George de Mestral studied burrs. And if you really look close, burrs have little hooks on the end. And so he developed a synthetic material that had this hook and loop structure. And essentially, he developed a Velcro. And that was from his study of these natural world or this biological process. So biomimetics has been going on for a long time. What does it look like in the modern sense? So here's a few different studies I'm going to present to you that have been published recently. This first one about the butterfly wings in 2012 in the journal Soft Matter. And when you look at butterfly wings under the microscope, you see this clabbered roof texture, sort of like overlapping shingles. And it was found that this particular structure is able to reduce drag when butterflies fly, and also to self-clean in some way. For some reason, dirt does not like to be on the surface. And so scientists have been able to take this idea and produce other surfaces that are really well-suited to medical equipment or operating rooms, where they design a surface that looks like this same structure, and thereby it stays cleaner, bacteria doesn't want to grow on it as much, even 80% cleaner than before, doing it a different way. So that inspiration came from butterfly wings. Porcupine quills are another interesting area. Students really love to write papers on these things. They find something fascinating about it, and it provides a great way to overlap your faith and design in nature also with the area you're studying, in my case, chemistry. We know porcupine quills are hard to remove because they're barbed. There's a little barb on the end. You can sort of see it in this picture, not so well here. This was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science in 2012. By looking at these barbs and seeing how they're constructed, we've been able to develop new adhesives, needles, and other medical devices. So literally, instead of using sutures, you can use this porcupine quill-inspired adhesive to hook tissues together without requiring any reactive chemistry, without requiring direct sutures in some way. You don't have to super glue the wound together or anything like that. So that comes from studying porcupine quills. The conch shell is another fascinating example. It's 95% made of calcium carbonate, yet we know it's a thousands of times stronger than just chalk, which is also calcium carbonate. So if we could take the structure of the calcium carbonate in the conch shell and build it up in the same way, we could produce super tough materials, synthetic materials that would be good for construction or aerospace applications. Turns out that the cross-layered structure of tiny crystals in this specific arrangement are 60 to 130 nanometers thick, can provide that sort of robust structure and strength. So the question is, if nature has already figured this out, why are we kind of behind the curve? And this is something that's discussed widely in a number of the different literature papers and books that you'll come in contact with, and we'll discuss that more as we move along. Let's look at silk. Silk is a great product, and it's good because it's 5 times stronger than steel, and at least 3 times tougher than Kevlar, and a great article was written in Chemical and Engineering News in 2014 on it, including a number of startup companies that produce silk-like products. They can take the relevant genes from spiders, put them in E. coli, and the E. coli can produce the building blocks of silk. And they then take that and they put it into cosmetics and shampoos. They create super smooth cosmetics and shampoos. I guess it actually feels a lot smoother. And so you can see down here, I guess it's a little difficult to read from CNE News, this is 4 or 5 different companies and how they produce the silk and what they put that into. These building blocks, however, in actual silk are connected in this way. It's a series of chemical building blocks that are hydrogen bonded together. So hydrogen bonds, although weak, can still provide high strength and actually hold these strands of silk together. Actually, that's what creates the strength of silk. So if we could figure out how to engineer something that holds together in the same way as silk does, we could take other materials, wood, plant fibers, and other things, yarns and whatnot, and also have them have great strength to produce other materials with that same property, which would be great. This was produced in Nature Materials in 2010. The other thing about silk, we're gonna talk about gecko feet. So silk is being discovered, a number of new companies are producing that. Geckos is another fascinating area, and this is the last example I'm going to show you about, and then we'll talk about kind of combining them together in some way. Geckos, as you might know, have the ability to stick to almost any surface. They can walk upside down, and it all comes down to how their feet are constructed. So if you look at a gecko foot, you see like these individual serrations, and then you zoom in on that, and it looks sort of like this. You then zoom in on that, and you get this hair-like structure, and the tips branch out. So it's suspected that some sort of intermolecular interaction takes place here that's really strong between these foot hairs and whatever surface the gecko is sticking to. And geckos can use this complex hierarchical adhesion system, both at this level and this level and this level, to stick to the surface somehow. A number of really fascinating studies have been carried out on these gecko feet. And they find that the geckos are also able to self-clean their feet through a process called hyperextension. So they actually put their feet into an apparatus and were able to find when they were not allowed to hyperextend, which is, this is what that looks like here, which somehow shakes the dirt off, and they modeled it physically over there. If they're not allowed to do that, their feet can get dirty and they don't stick as easily. So geckos shed dirt from their toes twice as fast as they would if they were walking without the hyperextension process happening, and it keeps their feet cleaner. If we could use or develop a new material that uses these same sort of properties, we would have an extremely sticky adhesive surface that could adhere to anything and remove very easily. And so a lot of people are working to that end. It even appeared on the cover of Advanced Materials in 2012. they were developing an adhesive. They called it the Gex skin. And this device, 16 inches square, about the size of an index card, can hold a maximum force of 700 pounds while adhering to a smooth surface such as glass. And you can't see it too well, but the Gex skin tape is right there, and it's connected down with a piece of glass to this TV. So for example, they stuck this 42-inch television to a wall, and they were able to release it with a gentle tug, restick it to the surface as many times as they needed, and there was no residue left behind. So this is an amazing technology, as long as you don't have a toddler running around pulling on your TV, right? Or you have enough money to buy more TVs. This is a reversible capacity as high as 2950 newtons, and so able to hold a lot of weight, remove easily, and restick through this Gex skin technology. So you can think of a lot of places that this would apply. The real question is, if you can develop spider silks, and you can develop gecko adhesive feet, maybe you could develop Spider-Man. Right? Or at least that's the first thing I thought of. Well, not quite, or close, I should say. One fascinating study I want to share with you, doing something similar to this, creating a system, a complex hierarchical adhesion system based upon gecko feet technology. So Journal of Society of the Royal Society Interface in 2015, this one came out earlier this year, they developed a series of sticky pads that connect through these strings, which emulate the tendons on the gecko feet, and hooking them all together in this special way, they were able to actually climb the side of a building or the side of a glass, which is the demonstration here. So in the practical demonstration, you can actually go to the website if you look up this reference, and you can see a video of this man climbing the side of the building here. They were able to lift a 70 kilogram human to climb a vertical glass with 140 square centimeters of adhesion per hand. So it's two hand pads, and they're connected through a rod support. You can see in this diagram a rod support where he sticks his foot at, so that way he has a place to stand while he moves them. Pretty fascinating. The first question I had was, who funded this work? Because it's pretty cool. DARPA. Anyway, you can look more on that if you want. The Z-Man project. So, sort of like Spider-Man, not exactly, but getting a lot closer. If that has been your dream, perhaps it will be reality soon. Now, all of these modern examples of biomimetics rely on advanced chemical materials, advanced chemical interactions, and you can even see biomimetics at the molecular level. I'm not going to tell you specifically about how they engineer new molecules to emulate enzymes and other things, although that's a fascinating area. You can do that, and you can design molecular systems that use, for instance, cyclodextrins, which is Ronald Breslow's work here. He coined the term biomimetic chemistry and did a lot of the original work of developing new molecules that have the same shape as naturally occurring enzymes, and that way they can carry out the same function. And he says, when chemists survey the marvelous chemical processes involved in life, they cannot fail to be amazed and inspired. Amazed at the spectacular chemistry that nature is using and inspired to learn from it, so as to invent chemistry that is better than what chemists have achieved to date. Which was a fascinating statement when I originally read this. He's essentially admitting that there is something in natural processes that we have a lot to learn from, and that somehow the genius is way above what current level we have, and that it's a great place to go for inspiration. So if you look closely at the biomimetics literature, you'll find very vague phrases that sort of reflect, in my opinion, it reflects their naturalistic worldview. Nature works her miracles. Life has some genius. There's a canon of nature's laws. Nature is your mentor. Evolution leaps to new levels of creativity. Of course, that may just be creative writing, but I think it reflects the naturalistic worldview that a number of these authors hold. And so let's look at that a little bit closer. Nature, life, and evolution are put forth sort of as this autonomous thing that are operating without any oversight that can give us some degree of awe which borders on reverence, she says in her book here. One is brought, I say, nearly to worship by studying nature's creativity. And so we see nature as mentor, our relationship, when we see it as our mentor, our relationship with the living world changes. We see an almost religious devotion to this abstract concept, this autonomous thing known as nature. And in my view, this puts nature as an idol. I think that if you're worshiping nature, it's definitely an idol. And so why is it, and how can we reevaluate this area to actually make it consistent with Christian theology or Christian belief? I think what we need to do is take biomimetics and put it under the lordship of Christ. It's not autonomous. It should not be worshipped as an idol. We need to think of creation and the nature that we're studying ultimately as a gift. It's not a burden, and it's not a burden because it's the substance of God's redemptive work. Ultimately, we know there'll be a new heavens and a new earth, and the world is being redeemed through the work of Christ on the cross. The present creation, which is cursed by man's fall, eagerly awaits and longs for the revealing of the sons of God, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from this bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God, Romans 8, 19 through 21. You can see this idea of developed a lot more in this good book by Jonathan Wilson, God's Good World, in 2013. He has a lot of really great things, and he develops a robust doctrine of creation. We also should see creation as a blessing. God's creation is the proper home of humankind and of our work and of our flourishing, and we can bring those things to the Lord, and we can properly experience beauty and know these things. If the universe is just a curse and a burden, as many people see it, and not a blessed creation, then beauty is an anomaly in the universe and is only a means of coping with the burden and curse, finding a bright spot amid all of the ugliness. So we should take creation and we should put it under the lordship of Christ. So in conclusion, biomimetics simply attempts to copy the genius of God, I say, as seen in nature, and it provides a creative means to advance technology and solve scientific problems. And most who work in the area of biomimetics inconsistently find rationality and purpose from naturalistic processes and exclude God. Creation is a gift and a blessing, and biomimetics can only rightly be appreciated when it's submitted to the lordship of Christ. Thank you for your attention. Any questions? Yes.
What is it about E. coli, about using that, that made it useful?
I think E. coli is well understood by biologists and can easily be genetically engineered, and that's why they have adapted it. I'm not a geneticist, and so I'm not sure their common techniques, but I know E. coli is used for a number of different genetic alterations and genetic engineering experiments. Over here.
How do your students respond to this idea of the biomimicry?
Very, very well. I tell them, here's a list of things on a handout, pick the one you want, write me a paper about it, include these things, discuss it this way. And so there's a lot of freedom for them if they're interested in medicine or medical school, or if they're interested in physical therapy or new materials or defense or, you know, whatever area they're interested in, they're able to find some topic that relates to chemistry and science and also to their worldview and to their interest. And so it's been a really great combination of those things.
Really good.
And
Where I know mimicry from, and biomimicry, I thought it was biomimicry, is just animals imitating other animals for various reasons, like the snake that isn't poisonous but looks exactly like the snake that is. Butterflies and wasps and stuff. I know it's more biology than chemistry, but do you ever talk about animals trying to
I haven't looked at any of that, honestly, because my interest is in materials and chemistry and chemical systems, and so I haven't discussed or read anything along those lines. I do have a colleague in the biology department who brought up a number of those things, gave me some book to read. I haven't got to it yet, though, but it's on my list.
Okay.
Back here.
Yes, it seems like this is, have you been able to develop any kind of undergraduate level research projects along this line?
I haven't. I would love to make that breakthrough and find some area where I can really connect them. Because I could get a lot of students really energized on this topic if I could find something that relates well enough. In my own undergraduate research work, we were able to purify water using developing a reactor. In essence, we got a patent on it. And whenever I tell students about that, it just blows their mind about how that's so applied. Oh, that relates directly to science. I'm so interested in engaging the world in that way. But I haven't been able to develop any topic or research area on my own yet that allows me at a small school to do all of that and overlap it. And of course, I'm open to any suggestions. I'd like to work more in that area. Anything else? Yes?
Some animals have built-in lights. Has anybody figured out how to use those processes to make lights?
There are several LEDs that have been inspired by biological bioluminescence and even chemiluminescence. I think one of the major breakthroughs of creating the blue LED came from studying some sort of a biological organism that produced similar wavelengths. I haven't looked at it in a lot of detail, so I can't comment further, but yes, people are studying that. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.